From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with John Fogerty, who was the lead singer and songwriter of the band Creedence Clearwater Revival. Their hits include Bad Moon Rising, Proud Mary, and Born on the Bayou. Fogerty's new CD is called Deja Vu All Over Again. Also, singer and actor Kris Kristofferson. He's just been elected to the Country Music Hall of Fame. Kristofferson has a new CD featuring fresh versions of his hits, Me and Bobby McGee, and Help Me Make It Through the Night. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD from alt-rocker Chris Stamey. And David Edelstein reviews the new film Vanity Fair. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Russian officials say that more than 200 people, many of them children, are dead after commandos stormed a school where more than 1,000 people were being held hostage. The Itar-Tass news agency quotes officials as saying commandos killed 27 hostage takers and captured 3 alive. NPR's Lawrence Sheets was outside the school as the commandos searched for militants.
We're hearing sporadic explosions from the area around the school. We're not sure what the nature of the explosions are. There are some reports that Russian troops are undertaking a cleansing operation in the area around the school just in case there are any militants left hiding out.
NPR's Lawrence Sheets reporting from Beslan, southern Russia. Russian officials say commandos stormed the building after the militants began setting off bombs. Strong winds and waves from Hurricane Francis are starting to pick up along Florida's southeastern shores. Local officials are warning people to stay off the streets and telling them where to go if they need shelter or medical attention. NPR's Jackie Northam reports from Orlando.
Forecasters say they are in a holding pattern, waiting to see how strong Hurricane Francis will be when it hits Florida, where exactly it will hit, and when. Some residents are still boarding up their houses. The shelves in many shops are near empty as people stock up on water and food. Mahmoud Haq was buying some last-minute provisions. He says he and his family, including a 3-week-old baby, will stay in a closet in the center of his apartment if the storm gets too bad.
We're trying to do our best to tape the windows, try to protect ourselves as much as possible.
Local officials in many counties are issuing a dusk-to-dawn curfew, some starting tonight, others beginning Saturday, when the full force of Hurricane Francis is expected to bear down on Florida. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Orlando.
Former President Bill Clinton is expected to undergo open-heart surgery soon at a hospital in Manhattan. Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton said today that her husband experienced chest pains and shortness of breath yesterday. President Bush announced the news to his supporters in Wisconsin today.
President Clinton has been hospitalized in New York. He is in our thoughts and prayers. We send him our best wishes for a swift and speedy recovery.
The Associated Press quoted one of Clinton's doctors as saying an angiogram showed the former president had significant blockage in the arteries of his heart, but did not suffer a heart attack. The heart problem surfaced just 2 weeks after Clinton's 58th birthday. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 30 points to close at 10,260 in very light trading. The Dow had gained 65 points for the week. The Nasdaq lost 29 points today to close at 1844. This is NPR News. The conflict in Sudan is the latest cause to be championed by humanitarian aid workers and musicians. They teamed up today to release a benefit album for victims of the violence. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from London.
Songs for Sudan is not the first rock and roll charity effort to benefit humanitarian crises. The 1972 Concert for Bangladesh and 1984's Band-Aid both did that. What's different is that this album is available only by internet download at bignoisemusic.com. It includes 17 tracks from Primal Scream, Badly Drawn Boy, and this live cut from the band R.E.M. The royalties from each $14 album will go to the humanitarian group Oxfam and provide drinking water for 15 refugees. Oxfam is already shipping plane loads of water and sanitation equipment to Sudanese refugees in Darfur. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, London.
The nation's unemployment rate fell slightly in August, while businesses added 144,000 new jobs to their payrolls. The Labor Department said the jobless rate was down a fraction to 5.4%, the lowest it's been since October of 2001. The number of new jobs created was slightly lower than most analysts had been predicting, but the Bush administration hailed it as a sign that the economy is growing stronger. Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry said the number of new jobs is a sign of continued weakness and a need to work for better job creation. The Labor Department said there were 8 million people unemployed in August, going an average of 19 weeks without work. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. John Fogerty was the lead singer and songwriter with the band Creedence Clearwater Revival. His new CD, Deja Vu All Over Again, is being released this month, and he's also appearing on one leg of the Vote for Change concert tour. On the same bill as Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, R.E.M., and Bright Eyes. With Vietnam a hot-button issue again in the current presidential campaign, Fogerty's anti-war anthems and other Vietnam-era songs have a new resonance, and his new collection of songs plays off that history. Between 1968 and 1972, the year Creedence broke up, the group had several gold records as well as 8 top 10 singles, including Proud Mary, Bad Moon Rising, Green River, Down on the Corner, and Looking Out My Back Door. For many years, Fogerty refused to perform the songs that made him famous because his old record company owned the rights to those songs. But in 1998, he returned to those songs on a live CD called Premonition. Terry spoke with him in 1998 when Premonition was released. Before we hear from Fogerty, let's listen to one of Creedence Clearwater's signature songs.
A lot of songs inspired by the South, like Born on the Bayou. You were actually born in El Cerrito, California, near Berkeley. And I'm wondering why in some of your songs you wrote first person in the persona of a Southerner.
Gee, that's a good question. I think I realized that talking about the main street of El Cerrito probably wasn't going to be something that was widely understood or even cared about. It didn't seem very interesting to me anyway, and the South has always fascinated me, and that's really the reason, the reason that I placed myself that way in my own songs. But if you want to ask me why am I so fascinated about the South, I really have to confess I don't know.
Because of the music?
Most of what I know about the South came through music, particularly the early forms of rock and roll, meaning rhythm and blues, and country music. And again, all those versions, I believe, were pretty romanticized. They, they were sort of rainbow-colored visions of the South in most cases.
Would your father have ever said what the father says in Born on the Bayou? Papa said, son, don't let the man get you and do what he done to me.
Yeah, he did say that a few different ways. My dad was a dreamer, unfortunately. He wasn't much of he didn't find great success in this world. But he was quite a dreamer and pretty literate. He read all the time, and he was inspired by all kinds of people that he passed on to me in kind of little snippets. I can remember when I was very, very young, my father reading the story of Dangerous Dan McGrew over and over. He loved that particular poem. He really loved Ernest Hemingway. He was a product of the 30s and 40s, I guess. My parents certainly were Depression era people, and I learned a lot of those lessons at their knee. And I think just by the way my dad ended up living his life, just by example, really, he was telling me, don't let the man get you and do what he done to me.
John Fogarty, do me a favor. Can you say two words for me, turning and burning?
Well, when I'm sitting here quietly in a library atmosphere, it is turning and burning. But when I sing, it always comes out toinen and boinen.
Yeah. I know. That's very New Orleans, isn't it?
Well, you know what? I didn't know where, really. Although I've noticed, because I just did it naturally. When I wrote the words, I wrote them to sound that way.
And the song in question is Proud Mary. Yeah.
Right. I've also noticed, though, that Howlin' Wolf has very much that sort of dialect in his music. I only spoke to him a couple times, but in his singing, you know, in the great songs that he did, he pronounces those words that way. But yes, down in New Orleans, a lot of people will say toinen and boinen.
Well, why don't we pause here and listen to your new recording of Proud Mary from your album Premonition. My guest is John Fogarty.
That's correct. Actually, we were still in the eighth grade, three of us.
Junior high school.
Right.
What were your early songs? What was the band like back in eighth grade?
Well, we were mostly an instrumental band. I patterned myself and my band very much around Duane Eddy, and we did several Duane Eddy instrumentals. Taking the pattern, basically, from Duane, I would play the melody on the guitar, and Stu, who was not yet playing bass, was playing piano, and I had kind of showed him the rudiments of, three-note chords and a little bass line. So, at that level of our development, we were certainly learning the rudiments of music, but always with a rock and roll flair, you might say. Rock and roll has some pretty strict parameters that you... When you step outside those parameters, everyone kind of gives you that crossed finger look, like they're holding back a vampire.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always kind of based everything from the center of rock and roll.
The band's first name was Tommy Fogarty. That's your brother, Tommy Fogarty and the Blue Velvets, and then the band was called, what was the second name?
Well, actually, originally, the three of us were the same age in the eighth grade, so we were just the Blue Velvets.
Oh.
And then we got the lucky happenstance to make a few records for a little local Bay Area label. And under that guise, Tom would join us. Tom, by that point, I think was out of high school, and of course we were still in high school. And, you know, under that recording name, we were Tommy Fogerty and the Blue Velvets.
And then what was the next name that you used?
The next name on records was the Gollywogs.
And what was the Gollywogs supposed to mean?
Well, this is one of those deals, because you're young and everybody else is supposedly older and wiser, and it's their record company. What the real story is, we worked on the first song for about 9 months. I mean, we had gone in there and recorded it, and we kept pressuring the record company to, when's it coming out? This is all of 1964. And then finally they tell us, well, the record's here, the pressings are here. So we rush over. Actually, I rushed over to San Francisco, and I pull on, you know, it's your first real record on a supposedly national label, Fantasy Records, and you want to look at this thing. And you take it out of the box, and I looked at it, and oh, my God, it said the Gollywogs. So Max was one of the brothers that owned the company then. I said, well, geez, Max, there's a mistake here. There's like a typo. They put the Gollywogs. No, we decided to rename you guys. Oh, well, why? See, a gollywog is in England, a gollywog is like a voodoo doll. It's this doll that comes from Africa. It's really a hip thing. It's really cool. And it's black, too. It's like from the black culture. And it's really cool. It's like a voodoo doll. And in England, it's really a hip thing. Of course, in 1964, the British had arrived in America, and all things English and British, mod, etc., were very cool. Unfortunately, no one in England had ever heard of a gollywog either.
How did you come up with the name Creedence Clearwater Revival?
Well, of course, after struggling under that name for several years, the ownership of Fantasy changed. And the very first thing we wanted to do was change our name. and the guy that had bought the company, the new owner of the company, agreed with us that we could change the name. I think he hated it too. And so we set about for many months trying to come up with a name, but none of it was very suitable or remarkable. The whole process started to bog down. I think it was Christmas Eve, and I was watching television, and two commercials came on television, one of which was a beer commercial that really promoted its use of the water, and they were showing this lush green woods and this flowing river, and you know, it was, the place looked enchanted, and there was this beautiful music in the background. And right after that was a black and white commercial. It was an anti-pollution commercial, and it showed all kinds of pollution and garbage in the water and that sort of thing. And at the end it said, if you want to change things, write to Clean Water Washington. And I was really taken by the two things back to back, the beautiful clear water and the, you know, terrible polluted water. And clean water stuck in my mind. I started playing with that. Clean water didn't seem like a very good name for a band, but I evolved to clear water. And I remembered back to when we had toyed at some point with the name Creedence. It's not true that I ever knew this person there, but we did know of a man whose first name was Creedence. Pretty unusual name. And, of course, I shuffled that around. Clearwater, Creedence, Creedence, Clearwater. Oh, I kind of liked that. But it still didn't sound complete. Remember, this is during the era of Jefferson Airplane and Strawberry Alarm Clock and Buffalo Springfield. So I kept playing around with different words, and I thought that what we were really doing was having a revival. The group, we had been together a long time, but we were now experiencing a revival, or at least I hoped so. So finally, after about probably 10 minutes of thought or even less, I had come up with the name. And I must say that the name was much better than we were at the time.
John Fogerty, formerly the lead singer of Creedence Clearwater Revival. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Let's get back to Terry's 1998 interview with John Fogerty, the former lead singer of Creedence Clearwater Revival. His new CD, Deja Vu All Over Again, is being released this month.
You wrote some politicized songs that pertain to the draft and to the war in Vietnam, like Fortunate Son, which is a song about how privileged people make wars, but the sons of the privileged are exempt from fighting them. And Who'll Stop the Rain, I think, was perceived as an anti-Vietnam song. I know you were in the reserves for a while. How did you end up in the reserves?
I was a very lucky guy, really. A local sergeant in a reserve unit took pity on me and basically let me join his unit when, the unit was full and there was really no place for me to go. He basically took pity on me and let me get into his reserve unit at the time.
So what year was that you were drafted?
1966.
So you were already recording then?
Oh, yeah.
And you didn't want to go to Vietnam, so you ended up in the reserves. I'm wondering if being in the reserves affected your attitude toward the war or toward the kinds of songs you wanted to write.
Oh, I would say very much, because, you quickly learn when you become a grunt in the military that you're just a number. You're just a piece of meat. You're nothing. You have no rights. You have no privileges. You have no power over what happens to you. And that's a very debilitating feeling. And I can remember, I can remember the night I finally arrived at my boot camp after being shuffled around for a couple of days, really. And it's your first day, and they keep you awake forever. You seem like you've been awake. And somewhere around midnight or 1 in the morning, all my guys got marched off to get our hair cut. And you kind of come back, you feel like you've been sexually abused. They say, okay, go back in there. And you go back in your barracks, and there's like 30 other people in the same boat, and you're all a bunch of ugly eggheads. And I laid down on my bunk, and I must confess a few, my eyes certainly watered, is I guess what I'm trying to say. Of course, you get over that because you're supposed to be a man. It was probably the most forlorn feeling I've ever had.
Did you see your song Who'll Stop the Rain as an anti-war song?
Yes.
Do you want to say anything about writing this song before we hear it?
Well, of course, the rain is a metaphor for the gobbledygook that comes down from the places on high. And I was feeling pretty much powerless at the time I wrote this song. And I was trying to reflect that really it seems to be, it has gone on since the beginning of time. And even at the time of the Vietnam War, when there was so much protest in the air, I had a very fatalistic point of view. It seemed like all the protesting in the world wasn't going to change anything.
Long as I remember.
From people who were fighting in Vietnam, that they played your records there a lot and that your records mattered to them while they were in the jungle?
I would hear that off and on right around the time of 1970, 71, but I heard about it a lot more later as I began to become an adult. And guys who were now back and settled into the community would tell me all kind of stories about Vietnam and the music that they experienced there.
And what did that mean to you?
Well, in some cases, it was very uplifting. I am proud that the songs meant so much. You know, I realized, of course, that all the music at the time meant so much, and especially to Americans off in a foreign land, in a jungle, fighting for their life. I mean, anything, these are kids, these are guys 20 and 21 years old. Anything that is a touch of home is a very welcome memory at that time.
John Fogerty was the lead singer of Creedence Clearwater Revival. He spoke to Terry in 1998. His new CD, Deja Vu All Over Again, is being released this month. We'll close with the title tune from that album. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Did you hear him talking about it on the radio? Did you try to read the writing on the wall? Did that voice inside you say, I've heard it all before? It's like deja vu all over. By day, I hear the voices rising, starting with a whisper like it did before. Day by day, we count the dead and dying, ship the bodies home while the networks all keep. Did you hear him talking about it on the radio?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, from TIAA Craft, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide. TIAA-CREF.org, and by The Dial Press, publisher of Sweet and Vicious, a modern love story about a tough guy on the run and the outrageous woman who tames his soul, by David Schickler, author of Kissing in Manhattan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Kris Kristofferson talks about his singing and acting career. He's just been elected to the Country Music Hall of Fame. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from indie rocker Chris Stamey. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Vanity Fair, starring Reese Witherspoon and Gabriel Byrne.
I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air. At age 49, Chris Stamey has been making punk and pop-influenced alternative rock for more than 20 years, most notably as co-leader of the band The DBs. In recent years, Stamey has worked extensively as a producer, for acts ranging from Yola Tango to Ben Folds to the Squirrel Nut Zippers. But rock critic Ken Tucker says Travels in the South, Stamey's first solo album in more than a decade, both returns him to his musical roots and sends him in a new direction.
The tune that leads off Travels in the South, the soaring 14 Shades of Green, seems at first like a passing autobiography. A song about homecoming that a superficial listen may lead you to think Stamey is talking about his native Chapel Hill, North Carolina. But if you can get past the happily jangling guitars and Stamey's wonderful vocal, part bluster, part exhilaration, you realize he's speaking in the voice of a cheerful loser. A guy who's giving you a tour of all the places he screwed up in when he was younger. Here's where we went to church, he sings. Here's where we robbed that store, he says, with equal affection. Steeped in a fictional nostalgia, the lyrics keep dissolving with acid wit. It's a great way to start off an album, setting a tone of genial skepticism. That song, Kierkegaard, unlike 14 Shades of Green, really does have what you expect from its title, gliding superficially across Kierkegaardian theories of God and his death. But he sets this philosophy 101 to a faux Beach Boys melody that gives greater force to Stamey's proclamation that, quote, there's not God in the sky, all you know is a lie. Atheism never sounded so fun till the biggest daddy in the universe takes the keys to your existential T-bird away.
Kenny Burrell doesn't know how to play out of tune. The orchestra swells across Fifth Avenue. Hal Blaine hits the drum so hard, you forget just where you
Throughout Travels in the South, Chris Stamey is playing with pop history, mixing and matching riffs and facts with a debonair disregard for the truth that only someone who really knows his subject can pull off. In that song, In Spanish Harlem, Stamey harmonizes with lovely earnestness with Tift Merritt, a female voice that adds intense longing to Stamey's cleverness. He seizes upon the Lieber and Stoller hit Spanish Harlem, throws in the names of real musicians who may or may not have had anything to do with making Spanish Harlem, and ends up with his own take on the original's poignant yearning. Although nearly every journey Chris Stamey takes in Travels in the South involves bringing along a pop music influence, by the end of every song, he's walking down that road alone, taking his own path down music history.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Travels in the South by Chris Stamey. Coming up, Chris Christopherson. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Songwriter, singer, and actor Kris Kristofferson was just elected to the Country Music Hall of Fame. His induction is in November. His songs include Me and Bobby McGee, For the Good Times, From the Bottle to the Bottom, and Help Me Make It Through the Night. Kristofferson arrived in Nashville in the 1960s, after living in England as a Rhodes Scholar and serving in the military. His first job in the music industry was working as a janitor at Columbia Records. It was there that he met Johnny Cash, who became his good friend, recorded Kristofferson's songs, and convinced Kristofferson to start recording himself. Kristofferson is as well known for his acting as for his singing. His films include Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, A Star is Born, Lone Star, Payback, and Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, which was just released on DVD as part of a Martin Scorsese box set. Terry spoke with Kris Kristofferson in 1999. Let's get started with his best-known song, Me and Bobby McGee.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge and heading for the trains. Feeling nearly faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained. Took us all away to New Orleans. I took my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana and was blowing sad while Bobby sang the blues. With them windshield wipers slapping time and Bobby clapping hands, we finally sang a velvet song that driver knew. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing ain't worth nothing, but it's free. Feeling good was easy, Lord, when Bobby sang the blues. Feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and Bobby McGee.
The most famous line from the song is freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. What inspired that line?
Well, that's what the song was really about to me, was the double-edged sword, you know, that freedom is. And when I wrote that, some of my songwriter friends in Nashville told me to take it out of the song, said it was that it didn't fit, that it, the rest of the imagery was so real and concrete that it was out of place to put a little philosophical line in there.
Tell me if I remember correctly, did you have a house that burned down at about the time you wrote the song?
No, I had had it. I'll tell you what I had. I was living in a condemned building at the time, and in a thing that cost me, I think, $50 a month. And somebody had broken into it during the week that I was down in the Gulf of Mexico and trashed the place and stole what little I had to steal. I remember it was a very liberating feeling to me because everything was gone and there was nowhere to go but up. I had also alienated my family at the time. My wife had left me and I was separated, you know, from my kids, and I think I'd been disowned by my parents by that time, and it was pretty liberating not having any expectations or anything to live up to.
What year did you first get to Nashville, and what was it like when you got there?
I first went there in June of 1965, and was on my way back from a 3-year tour in the Army in Germany, and was on my way to the career course down at Fort Benning, and from there to supposedly to teach English at literature at West Point. And since my military obligation was already fulfilled, I decided I was going to get out of the Army and be a songwriter. I had spent a couple weeks there just on tour. I mean, just, you know, I was on leave and got shown around to some of the songwriter sessions and got a glimpse of the life. I've always felt like I was really lucky to have been exposed to Nashville at that time, because I'm sure it's different now.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kris Kristofferson, songwriter, singer, and actor. How did you start making movies? Did you think, one day I'm going to act?
When I started performing my own songs, my first the first place I ever played was at Troubadour Club in Los Angeles. It was kind of a hangout like the Bitter End in New York. And I think at the time there was more people looking for new blood, because I got a lot of offers just off of performing there. And eventually Harry Dean Stanton gave me a script. I didn't even know he was an actor at the time. I thought he just sang in the bar there at the Troubadour. But he helped me do a screen test for a film that was called Cisco Pike. And I got to put my music in it. And I was the lead in it, in a film with Gene Hackman and Karen Black and Harry Dean. And just went on from there.
Compare the roles that you get now with what you got early on. You're often playing the heavy now.
Yeah, I think that's thanks to John Sayles.
And Lone Star.
In Lone Star, yeah.
Yeah, where you played a sadistic sheriff.
Yeah, it was so different from most of the roles that I played before that mm-hmm. That I think people finally thought I was acting. I'm not sure anybody thought I'd ever acted before that.
Well, I thought I'd play a short scene from Payback. And in this movie, Mel Gibson is a con man who's getting revenge on the people who conned him out of $70,000 and also shot him and left him for dead. You play somebody who heads a crime syndicate, and Mel Gibson has kidnapped your son and is holding him hostage until you deliver the $70,000. But now you've got Mel Gibson tied up, and you're trying to get him to tell you where he's holding your son. And here you are threatening him.
Here it is. $130,000. That's as close as you're ever going to get to it. But I'll make you a deal. Tell me where John is and I'll finish you quick. I promise you won't have to find out what your left ball tastes like. But if there's even a bruise on him, I'll make this last 3 weeks. I'll give you a blood transfusion to keep you alive if I have to. Where is he?
That's Kris Kristofferson in a scene from Payback. How'd you get this part?
Well, they had actually finished the film and apparently weren't satisfied with the way it worked. And they created this character for me to play. And I went in and shot a week. And I told Mel, I said, yeah, there's not any pressure on me. The whole film doesn't work, and you're expecting me to repair it in a week. But I think I got it because of playing Charlie Wade, you know, in the Lone Star.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to close with another song from your new CD, The Austin Sessions. And this is a song called The Pilgrim, Chapter 33. Now, this song is quoted in Taxi Driver. The Sybil Shepherd character, Betsy, buys the record for Travis, the taxi driver played by Robert De Niro, and she says that he reminds her of the character in the song, and she quotes the line, "He's a walking contradiction, partly truth and partly fiction." How did the song end up in Taxi Driver?
I don't know. I always felt like that was the nicest thing that Marty Scorsese ever did to me.
I guess you had already worked with him, and Alice doesn't live here anymore.
Yeah, yeah, but I didn't know it was going to be in that one, and God, he had there's De Niro holding up my album, and they're quoting me like Bob Dylan or something. It was. I still think that's one of the sweetest things I've ever seen anybody do for anybody in the business.
And who did you write the song about?
Well, I wrote it about myself and about a lot of friends of mine that I thought were, you know, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Chris Gantry, Johnny Cash, and everybody I knew at the time. And a lot of us were 33 at the time. That's why it's called Chapter 33. And Dennis Hopper. I remember when we were down in Peru, every time that you would tell somebody you were 33 years old, they'd say, "Ah, the age of Christ." So that sort of fit the pattern of it.
So were you referring at all to how you and a lot of people you knew were kind of self-invented?
Oh, yes. Yes. Partly truth and partly fiction. You know, I've always felt that I and many of the people I admire are figments of our own imagination. I always felt that Willie Nelson, Muhammad Ali, were particularly successful at that, at imagining themselves and living up to what they imagined themselves to be. When I first saw Muhammad Ali, he was Cassius Clay. He was a little skinny, light heavyweight over in Rome. And he was telling everybody he was going to be the biggest, the best. You know, he was the next Joe Louis, and he imagined himself right up into that.
Do you feel you did that too?
I think I did. When I think back to when I first was writing my first songs, you know, like when I was 11 years old, down in Brownsville, Texas, I think that I imagined myself into a pretty full life after that. I was certainly not equipped by God to be a football player, but I got to be one. And I got to be a ranger and a paratrooper and a helicopter pilot, you know, and a boxer. And a lot of things that I don't think I was built to do. I just imagined them.
Chris Christopherson, speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. Christopherson has just been elected to the Country Music Hall of Fame. His induction will be in November. Here's that clip from Taxi Driver, featuring Robert De Niro and Cybill Shepherd.
You want to go to a movie with me?
I have to go back to work now.
Well, I mean now. I mean like another time, though.
Sure. You know what you remind me of?
What?
That song by Chris Christopherson.
Who's that?
The songwriter. He's a prophet. He's a prophet and a pusher. Partly truth, partly fiction. Walking contradiction.
You're saying that about me?
Well, who else would I be talking about?
I'm no pusher. I never have pushed.
No, just the part about the contradiction. You are that.
He's a poet.
He's a liar.
He's a prophet.
He's a dreamer.
He's a pilgrim man to preach.
A problem when he's stoned.
He's a walking contradiction, partly truth, mostly fiction. Taking every wrong direction on his lonely way back home.
Coming up, a review of the new film Vanity Fair. This is Fresh Air. William Thackeray's novel Vanity Fair was first published in serial form in 1847. It tells the story of two women, the poor but ruthlessly ambitious social climber Becky Sharp and her friend Amelia Sedley. The new movie from the Indian director Meera Nair stars Reese Witherspoon and a cast of veteran British actors, including Bob Hoskins, Eileen Atkins, and Jim Broadbent. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
There's something admirable about interpreters, directors and actors both, who attempt to correct for the prejudices of the cultural past. Consider a Shylock turned into a monster against his better nature by the bigotry of his day, or Reagan and Goneril as good daughters doing their best with that capricious patriarch Lear, or consider Becky Sharp not as the near demonic schemer of William Thackeray's Vanity Fair, attractive for her boldness, yet repugnant for the way in which she uses people without conscience, but a gifted young woman, understandably driven to overcome the arbitrary restrictions of a sexist and fiercely class-driven society. As I've said, admirable. But in the case of Vanity Fair, directed by Meera Nair and starring Reese Witherspoon as a Becky far more sinned against than sinning, it's also nuts. You don't need to have waded through Thackeray's witty dissection of the English upper class at the dawn of the 19th century to know that what you're seeing on screen makes absolutely no sense. You'd have no idea, for a start, that Becky is one of the great comic female characters in literature, a woman whose take on the society that has shunned her is too deeply ironic to allow for trust or love. As a gifted improviser, she's able to keep her emotions in check and form tears on command. And when decency peeks through, as in her affection for her guileless friend, Amelia Sedley, it's a momentous event. But in Nair's take, that decency is the rule, not the exception. And so the story has no driving force, no engine. Reese Witherspoon has a great camera face, gorgeous but funny looking, with acres of cheekbone and a strong jaw that ends in a goofy little chin. She has crack timing and a laser stare that incinerates opponents where they stand, and she was a howl as a sort of Becky Sharp crossed with Sammy Glick in Election. Even her L in Legally Blonde had a will of iron. But her Becky is a complete dud. In the late stages of pregnancy, she's been costumed to conceal her body. She moves tentatively, and her twittery little voice sounds flat and inexpressive beside these great English stage actors. She's a passive little thing, preyed upon by assorted rich men and unjustly accused of being a conniver. A conniver! The average contemporary soap heroine has more commanding wiles. So while the film is extremely faithful to the novel's incidents and dialogue, its meaning has been altered by 180 degrees. When Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, as her best friend's husband, attempts to put the moves on Becky at a dance, it's a real head-scratcher. He's callow and effeminate, she's sexless, and the exchange comes out of nowhere because the adapters have cut all the stuff in which Becky has flirted outrageously with him. The Marquess of Steyne, her deliciously monstrous co-conspirator played by Gabriel Byrne, is now a Svengali figure.
We meet at last.
I know you, Lord Steyne, though you do not know me. You will have forgotten, but you were kind to my father once, many years ago.
I'm seldom praised for being kind. What was his name?
Francis Sharp.
You are Francis Sharp's daughter. He had a great talent for painting, as I recall, and none at all for life.
I'm attempting to redress that balance. It is my challenge.
Gabriel Byrne is magnetic, a dark lord who's more dangerous as a friend than an enemy, and a scene in which he cruelly taunts his wife, daughter, and daughter-in-law is the film's most chilling. And what a supporting cast! That magnificent old bird, Eileen Atkins, Jim Broadbent as a father deformed by avarice, Bob Hoskins as a slovenly aristocrat, such nuanced dissolution. Romola Garry is almost too pretty and interesting as Amelia, but the character has gained in stature as Becky has plummeted. As Nair demonstrated in Monsoon Wedding, she has an eye for color and spectacle, and she composes frames in Vanity Fair where you're distinctly aware of the menials serving at the pleasure of their betters without ramming that caste system down your throat. But her grasp of character is simple-minded. I wonder if anything could have made this misfire work. Perhaps making Thackeray himself a presence, the biographer of Becky, who will do her the final injustice of misinterpreting her motives? No. Thackeray gave us an antihero who has endured in the collective imagination for 150 years. This dull feminist victim won't linger past Labor Day.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the German Information Center, the shortcut to Germany on the web at www.germany.info. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the Labor Day edition of Fresh Air, we consider the kind of boss who prides himself on being smart and enlightened, but really is neither. Ricky Gervais plays a nightmare boss in the BBC sitcom The Office. Also, filmmakers Peter and Bobby Farrelly. The two brothers have become practically the brand name for bad taste. Join us for the next Fresh Air.